Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Department of Modern Languages and Comparative Literature in the College of Arts and Sciences. Tonight's lecture is titled Seeing Chekhov Whole on Translating the Complete Plays of Anton Chekhov and features Tufts University professor Lawrence Sinelic. We begin with an introduction from Keith Vincent, Assistant Professor of Japanese and Comparative Literature at Boston University.
It's my great pleasure to introduce Lawrence Sinelic, who is Professor of Drama at Tufts University, an Alt Fellow of the Wissenschaftskolleg zu Berlin, and a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. His many books include the award-winning The Chekhov Theater, The Changing Room, Sex, Drag, and Theater, The Age and Stage of George L. Fox, and Lovesick, Modernist Plays of Same-Sex Love, 1895 to 1925. His translations of plays from 9 languages have been frequently performed. Last year, he published the anthology The American Stage in the Library of America. His work has been recognized by grants from the NEH, the ACLS, and the Guggenheim Foundation, and he's been awarded the St. George Medal of the Russian Federation for services to Russian art and scholarship. And recently he has translated the complete plays of Anton Chekhov, about which he's going to talk to us today. So thank you so much for coming.
My pleasure. When I was a graduate student in comparative literature at Harvard, in the palmy days of Harry Levin and Renato Pajoli, there was a riddle that circulated throughout the department. Who is the greatest Russian writer of the 19th century? The answer? Constance Garnett. Certainly for Anglophone readers in the first half of the 20th century, and for some time afterwards, it was her genteel English voice which emanated from the pages of the Russian classics. 17 volumes of Turgenev, 13 volumes of Chekhov's tales and 2 volumes of his plays, 13 volumes of Dostoevsky, 6 volumes of Gogol, 4 volumes of Tolstoy, and 6 volumes of Herzen, not to mention occasional renderings of Goncharov, Gorky, Ostrovsky, and a collection of folk songs issued from her hand. These Herculean labors were carried out between 1893 and 1922 by a Cambridge-educated wife and mother in poor health who did her own gardening, cooking, and entertaining, and who visited Russia only twice, briefly. Such familiarity with the Russian greats would suggest that Constance Garnett was a shrewd evaluator of their qualities. Who knows? She never wrote about them. It was her husband, Edward, who penned the introductions to the Turgenev and Gorky volumes and who published a book about Tolstoy. Yet Constance Garnett had the inestimable advantage of knowing firsthand the texts of these masters. Close acquaintance should have enabled her to make critical pronouncements of considerable acumen. Instead, she left evaluations to literati such as Arnold Bennett, E.M. Forster, and Catherine Mansfield, who, of course, based their judgments on her translations and those of others. And because of her haste and her less than indigenous knowledge of Russian, Garnett tended to make all her authors sound like one another, neutralizing their individual qualities. In this respect, Garnett is hardly an isolated case, since the current practice in the theater is for playwrights and directors to undertake so-called translations of languages they don't know, few questions are asked about the specificity of a text. Yet even someone with a solid knowledge of the Russian language should be aware that in the translation of Chekhov, what is being translated is not Russian per se. It is Chekhov's wielding of Russian. One is dealing not only with a language which is not one's own, but the artistically wrought language of a creative artist. Working on a translation, it's essential for one to inquire into the precise connotation of a word or a phrase at the turn of the 19th century as it was used by Chekhov. For instance, in Uncle Vanya, when Voynitsky complains that Yelena's faithfulness to her husband is falshivy, to translate this by the English false is to select what used to be called a faux ami, a seemingly exact but actually imprecise counterpart. The word appears in Chekhov's writing only in such phrases as falshivaya moneta, falshivaya bilyeti, counterfeit money. And therefore what is meant here is something like phony, fake, bogus. Or note, in the first version of Ivanov, how Count Shabelsky cannot address Anna, the Jewish renegade, without a Yiddish exclamation or an anti-Semitic joke. So, in Act One of the last version of Ivanov, the one that's always translated, when we hear the Count's voice from inside the house railing at Anna's piano technique, "You've got no more ear for music than a farshirovanaya ryba, a stuffed fish," the reference is not taxidermic but culinary. All previous translators have rendered this as stuffed fish or stuffed trout, but the Zhidovka, the Jewess, is being rebuked for having no more ear than a gefilte fish. There is no Russian term for stuffed fish in the taxidermic sense. In the process of translating, I try to be alert to such hidden jokes. Whenever I attend a Chekhov performance in Russian, I pay close attention to when the audience laughs and try to prompt a similar response in English. One has to be careful in this respect, however. Some older Russians have a hard time keeping a straight face at Sonia's famous image at the end of Uncle Vanya. "Мы увидим все небо в алмазах." We shall see all heaven in diamonds. Because in Josef Heifetz's popular 1958 movie, My Dear Man, an abusive father keeps threatening his family that he will make them see all heaven in diamonds. Admittedly, one can go overboard in searching for idiosyncrasies. A French translator of Pirandello, Jean-Louis Rivière, thought he detected an asthmatic impulse in Pirandello's structure of linked short sequences, which suddenly explode into a long one. He was disappointed to learn that the Italian dramatist did not suffer from asthma. But he did discover that Pirandello smoked 100 cigarettes a day. Did shortness of breath affect his dramatic construction? Can one perceive a tubercular cause for Chekhov's prose style or his preference for short forms? Taken as a whole, Chekhov's dramatic output continually reflects back on itself. A remarkably ecological writer, Chekhov recycled not only ideas but expressions. The same phrases crop up in his letters and in his stories as in his plays, which abets the notion that Chekhov's is a closed world. One of his favorite juvenile quotations, the phrase "obscured by the veil of ignorance," has never been tracked down to a particular source, but turns up on Lopakhin's lips the year of Chekhov's death in Cherry Orchard. Play without a title, usually called Platonov, and along the highway are stockpiles of Chekhovian themes and phrases. Glagolov Jr., with his 35 telegrams from Paris in Platonov, is a forerunner of Ranevskaya's lover, as well as Yasha in the Cherry Orchard. Voynitsev has been offered a job in Platonov, but it's speculated that he won't take it because he's too lazy, as Lopakhin will say later of Gaev in the Cherry Orchard. George Steiner used to claim that interviewing candidates for Oxford, he was favorably impressed when a prospective student admitted to having read the complete works of a given author. Seeing Chekhov whole, examining how he used the language throughout his writing, can only aid a translator in making choices. Even if Constance Garnett failed to distinguish the individual traits of authors or to capitalize on her familiarity with the writers she put into English, much may be said for translating the whole body of a writer's work. After Garnett, the next aspirant to her laurels has been David Magashak, whose output, largely disseminated by Penguin Books in the 1950s and 60s, temporarily supplanted hers. In the matter of Chekhov, he was outdone, however, by Ronald Hingley, who produced the Oxford Chekhov between 1964 and 1983. It was not a truly complete edition, since Hingley omitted most of the early humorous fiction, the journalism, the letters, and the first version of Ivanov. But it did provide notes, variants, and commentary on publication history, all of which was lacking in Garnett's volumes. The chief problem with Hingley's translations, and this holds true for those of Magashak as well, is that they sought to assimilate Chekhov to to a supposititious English common reader. I should say British common reader. They attempted to de-Russify the text. Hingley, in particular, seems to have made the perverse decision, whenever possible, not to follow Chekhov's sentence structures or word order, and to rely on English clichés and catchphrases when confronted with particularly flavorsome Russian idioms. He made no effort to preserve the careful repetition of words, let alone the rhythms, in Chekhov's later writing. Hingley went so far as to translate peasants as the locals, and to change Russian names to English ones, Pavel and all its diminutives, Pasha, Pava, Pavochka, etc., to Paul, for instance. He was not consistent in this, however, which makes the practice all the more awkward. The result is that although Hingley was more aware than his predecessors and many of his successors that Chekhov writes a very colloquial language, his renderings sound nowadays, especially to an American ear, like a disoriented P.G. Wodehouse. Pointing out the flaws in other people's translations is a pleasant enough indoor sport, but there's something more cogent to be discovered than incompetence or wrongheadedness. If one were to examine all the renderings of Chekhov's plays into English, from Max Mandel and George Calderon at the beginning of the 20th century to the present, one could trace in them the history of translation and of the Anglophone world's relationship to Chekhov and the evolution of modernist ideas of theater. Translation contains in itself the conditions of its emergence. It puts a text into a state of crisis, which is stimulating and provocative. Every attempt at translation is relative, bound to circumstances. The translator must stop at a given moment, even though he'd like to rework his text endlessly. A translation always needs to be redone. About 10 years ago, I was approached by W.W. Norton to revise their critical edition of Chekhov's plays, edited and translated by the late Eugene Bristow. Having 35 years' experience of translating and retranslating the major plays for various productions, I persuaded them to start from scratch with an edition that would include more plays and fresh renderings based on the 30-volume Chekhov issued by the Russian Academy of Sciences in the 1980s, along with a different selection of critical essays. The customary practice among publishers is to combine Chekhov's big four in one volume, occasionally including the final version of Ivanov. The one-act plays are usually lumped together in a separate volume. This may make marketing sense, since the average reader may not be looking for more than a nodding acquaintance with the plays. For the serious student who does not have access to Russian, it creates a false impression. The close interaction between the one-acts and the full-length plays, their variations on themes, becomes clearer when they're offered in chronological order. The need to present Chekhov's plays as a totality led me to a step beyond. The momentum I'd build up on the selected plays led to a translation of the complete plays published in one volume by W.W. Norton. Complete is, of course, a weasel word, but this edition intended to be fuller than any previously in print. My remit encompassed early comic pieces in dialogue, as well as the first version of Ivanov, and the power of hypnotism, a farce Chekhov sketched out with his friend Ivan Leontiev Shchegolov, and which had not been published in any language since 1911. I also made sure to include a copious number of variants, along with thorough annotation. This is not to say that Chekhov is like Ibsen in regarding his dramatic output as chapters of a single book. Ibsen, during his tenure as dramaturg in Bergen, had learned how to turn out a five-act play annually, and later in his career, every 2 years. In his realistic phase, his plays constitute a debate with one another. An enemy of the people argues against lying to the public. The next play, The Wild Duck, argues for the necessity of illusion. Chekhov, however, saw himself primarily as a writer of short fiction, with drama as a sideline. His early plays are occasional, prompted by requests to provide material for actors or to bring in needed funds through performance royalties. Only later was Chekhov inspired by his own creative urgency. Everyone knows that he once said that medicine was his legitimate wife, literature his mistress. In that case, playwriting was a series of one-night stands. Plays in pre-revolutionary Russia had to undergo two censorships, one for publication and one for performance. What is striking about the language of the early plays Platonov and Along the Highway, which were never performed in Chekhov's lifetime, is the freedom of the dialogue. Words and phrases, not to mention situations, which would never pass the stage censorship, are used in abundance, giving the dialogue a vivacity that does not correspond to the standard notion of what is Chekhovian. The plebeian idiom of Along the Highway may come from more from literary sources than from things heard, though. There's something artificial about its folksy vernacular. In both cases, the language is more forceful, more slangy, more audacious than anyone would expect from a beginner. I would suggest that as Chekhov became more familiar with the conventions of the professional stage, he exercised a kind of self-censorship. His stops to Cerberus may be seen in his replacement of certain lines in The Seagull concerning Arkadina's affair with Trigorin, and in The Cherry Orchard concerning the student Trofimov's past and his views on serfdom. As he famously wrote to Olga Knipper in 1903, Chekhov said, "The things that worried me most were the second act's lack of action and a certain sketchy quality in Trofimov, the student. After all, time and again, Trofimov is being sent into exile. Time and again, he's being expelled from the university. But how can you spell out stuff like that?" Nevertheless, these revisions concern content, not form. Even as early as Platonov, Chekhov realized the dramatic power of a verbal leitmotif. Retired Colonel Ivan Ivanovich Trilyetsky enters in Act One, blithely saying, "God is patient and hasn't punished me." He vanishes from sight until the end of the play, when he has the last line, "God has lost patience and is punishing me." For the most part, however, Chekhov's attention to language in his playwriting came late. Several of the early vaudevilles were dashed off in a couple of hours or days, as Chekhov himself boasted in his letters. The same holds true for the first version of Ivanov, which was composed in a week and a half, almost on a bet. In that notorious case, Chekhov spent the rest of his life revising and touching up this burst of creativity. But his revisions had more to do with clarifications of character and motive than with the niceties of dialogue. Even his radical alteration of the last act and the protagonist's suicide were made with an eye to the actor's capabilities and the audience's responses, not to Chekhov's artistic imperatives. In Ivanov, as later, Chekhov's tendency is to excise the over-explicit and the redundant, to prune away excesses. In the first version, many of the lines end in exclamation marks, but in the rewriting for the Alexandra Theater in St. Petersburg, these are replaced by ellipses. Chekhov's next major play, The Wood Goblin, is remarkable for a thoroughgoing revision of the third act peripeteia and a consequent new fourth act, which transforms it from a society melodrama to a comedy. Its next avatar, Uncle Vanya, shows new attention to detail, a concision, and particularly a linguistic organizing principle. Sidebar here. I choose to translate Dr. Khrushchev's nickname Lieshi as wood goblin rather than the standard wood demon, because wood demon makes too diabolic an impression. The mischievous sprite whom the ancient Slavs and their posterity believed inhabited the forests is closer to Puck or Robin Goodfellow in his fondness for leading travelers astray and imitating the sounds of various animals. In Chekhov's day, Russians said Lieshi vazmi as a mild expletive, the way an Englishman might say, deuce take it. Uncle Vanya is knit together by words formed on duch and dusch, spirit and breath, to provide a sense of oppression. In the very first lines of dialogue, Astrov declares, "Dushna, it's stifling." And variations on that sentiment are struck with regularity. Vanya repeats it and speaks of Yelena's attempt to muffle her youth. The professor begins Act Two by announcing that he cannot breathe, and Vanya speaks of being choked by the idea that his life is wasted. Ostrov admits he would be suffocated if he had to live in the house for a month. The two young women fling open windows to be able to breathe freely. During the first two acts, a storm is brewing and then rages. And Vanya spends the last act moaning, "Tyazhelo menye," literally, "It is heavy on me. I feel weighed down." At the very end, Sonia's "We shall rest," "Мы отдохнем," is etymologically related to "dushna" and connotes breathing freely. The standard English translation, "We shall rest," unfortunately ends with a decisive dental sound and not a long drawn out and softer vocable, "отдохнем." I tried to ameliorate it in the Norton Critical Chekhov as "We shall be at rest," but for the complete Chekhov, I translated it as "We'll be at peace." The same number of syllables ending in a sound that can be protracted and spelling out what is implied in Sonia's aria. Another important verbal motif in Vanya is folkloric. With a nod to the earlier Leshy, the wood goblin, the dialogue refers to the Domovoy, the Vadyavoy, and the Rusalka, the house goblin, the water sprite, and the naiad. As in Seagull, the Rusalka is mentioned in connection with an omut. I'll get back to that. Terpyov refers to Pushkin's unfinished verse play Rusalka in regard to Nina. And later Nina says that both he and she have fallen into the omut. Now in this context, it might be translated as whirlpool or maelstrom, but its use in Vanya, the suggestion that Yelena dive plop into an omut, reveals its alternative meaning is intended, a mill race, precisely the body of water into which Pushkin's heroine threw herself to become a Rusalka. Similarly, when Astrov remarks of Yelena, "Она прекрасна, спора нет," "She is beautiful, no argument," he's quoting Pushkin's version of Snow White in the tale of the Tsar's dead daughter and the seven warriors. The evil Tsarina turns to her mirror with the question whether she is really the fairest in the land, and the mirror replies, "Ти прекрасна, спора нет," "Fair art thou, no contest there," "But the Tsar's daughter still more fair." These are what I call embedded quotations, less obvious than the explicit citations from Lermontov and Nekrasov, but a translator must be alert to them in order to preserve the thematic flavor of the original. The tighter construction of language in Chekhov's later plays comes from the fact that Chekhov, now reasonably well-to-do, no longer regarded the stage merely as a financial milk cow to be pumped while he concentrated on his fiction. Writing from his newly purchased farmstead in Melikhovo to his friend Suvorin, who had founded a theater in Petersburg, Chekhov announced, "I, too, will write a play especially designed for your circle. I will write something strange. For the state and for money, I have no desire to write. For the time being, I am comfortable and can afford to write a play for which I will get nothing. If circumstances alter, then it'll, of course, be a different tune." This is believed to be the first mention of what would turn out to be the Seagull. By not writing for the Imperial Theaters or for the box office, Chekhov was able to suit himself and to devote more time to crafting his language. In this new attention to detail, a commonplace uttered in the first act may return to resonate with fresh significance. When Astrov complains that when people can't understand him, they call him strange or peculiar, strany, later, Yelena uses that very word to describe him, thereby revealing that she doesn't understand him. The same holds true for chudak, crackpot, and its derivatives, which keep cropping up in the course of the play. As in Uncle Vanya, the incohesive elements of the Seagull are held together by language. Whatever their naturalistic psychologies and social positions, the characters are largely composed of linguistic tics and obsessions. Uncle Sorin's Vikonsia Konsov, when all said and done, and Masha's Pustiaki, nonsense or trivia. These artificial formulas, this sense that each character is programmed to keep saying the same thing over and over again, contributes to an illusion of reality. The recurrence of the same idea or an identical phrase is not simply the sign of the protagonist's boredom or the mark of a morbid compulsion for repetition. It structures the text by reducing it to a finite series of themes, constantly resumed or varied. Certain words, iterated 6 or 7 times, characterize an individual. Others crystallize an obsession or a general neurosis, such as the words talent, talent, znat, know, and its derivatives, such as uznat, to describe. The repetition of these words bespeak a general desire to be recognized by others as a loving person, and for Trepliov, Arkadina, Trigorin, and Nina, as an artist. Incidentally, Chekhov almost never uses the word art. He prefers talent as his signifier for genius and ability. The characters communicate or fail to communicate through recollection, quotation, not just literary, but of one another. Inarticulate sounds, such as Dr. Dorn's humming and Sorin's whistling. As in Chekhov's farces, the characters talk past one another without any genuine attempt to persuade anybody else. Rather than expressing a given character, language escapes them to be relayed and transmitted by the character along a subtextual underground railway. Often, the verbal dialogue breaks off at the very point when the characters are just about to make a statement. As Patrice Pavy puts it, the peculiar power of Chekhov's text originates as a sort of teasing, never explaining, never providing the key to the quotations or to the characters. Echo is one of Chekhov's favorite effects. It suggests to the spectator, placed in the position of omniscient auditor, that an action, a situation, an expression has clearly been put in evidence, and this repetition makes some sense. Echo is also more or less masked citation of one's own or someone else's remark. "It gets you going in circles," declares Medvedenko to Masha about his paltry salary at the start of the play. And Dorn picks up the phrase when the schoolmaster starts complaining about the price of flour in the next act. "Gets you going in circles." When Nina Zaryechnaya characterizes Konstantin's play as a chitka, a mere read-through, we realize she must have picked up this bit of backstage slang from listening closely to Arkadina. In Act 1, Konstantin offers to stand outside Nina's house and stare at her window. In Act 4, he speaks of standing for hours outside her hotel, while Nina herself haunts the grounds of the estate and fails to come in. The translator must be alert to the echoic effect between different characters who are not on stage at the same time, but who come to the same conclusions. In the first act of Siegel, Konstantin describes Trigorin's writing as charming, talented, but compared to Tolstoy or Zola, a little Trigorin goes a long way. In Act 2, Trigorin describes his own writing as charming, but a far cry from Tolstoy. The same principles of linguistic construction apply to Chekhov's last two plays. In Three Sisters, the prevalent state of mind is regularly expressed by nadoyel. I'm sick and tired. I'm fed up. In his brief interlude alone with Masha in Act 2, Colonel Vershinin blames the average local intelligent for being sick and tired of his wife, sick and tired of his estate, sick and tired of his horses. But he's clearly characterizing himself, for he soon draws a picture of his own wretched marriage. Masha, whom Vershinin would exempt as an exceptional person, is sick and tired of winter, and when her husband proclaims his love with, "I'm so happy," she bitterly spits back, "I'm sick and tired, sick and tired, sick and tired," thus aligning herself with the fellow townsman she detests. Even the genteel Olga pronounces herself sick and tired of the fire. The unanimous response to this spiritual malaise is a commonplace fatalism. Dr. Chebutykin's dismissive, "Monsieur Ravno, doesn't matter, it's all the same," reverberates through the other characters as well. Vershinin uses "Monsieur Ravno" to deny differences between the military and the civilians. Tuzenbach describes his resignation from the army in those words. Salyoni denigrates his love for Irina with the phrase, "Monsieur Ravno." According to Irina, Andrei's debts don't matter to Natasha. This deliberate insouciance is the counterbalance to the equally deliberate velleities about the future. Chekhov's intention to employ this leitmotif is evident from the fact that in his final revision of the play, he inserted the Sieur Ravenel into Chebutikin's dialogue 6 separate times. In The Cherry Orchard, every character speaks in a particular cadence. Compare Pishchik's short asthmatic phrases with the run-on grandiloquence of Trofimov, or with Anya's iambic meters. Changes are rung on the word nischastye, unhappiness, misfortune, from Yepechodov's nickname, 22 Misfortunes, to Ranevskaya's narrative of her unhappy past, to Fierce's characterization of the emancipation of the serfs. Of course, an umbrella misfortune overhangs the whole play, the sale of the estate. After much searching, I decided to replicate this recurrence with troubles. Yepechodov becomes tons of troubles. Ranevskaya speaks of her troubles, and Fierce refers to freeing the slaves as the troubles. Another important repetition is the earthy term nedatyopa, uttered regularly by Fierce and which is the last line in the play. Translators grow gray over the word. Earlier English versions have good for nothing, rogue, duffer, job lot, lummox, silly young cuckoo, silly old nothing, nincompoop, muddler, silly galoot, numbskull, young flibbertigibbet. In fact, nedatyopa was not a Russian word when Chekhov used it. It was Ukrainian for an incompetent or a mental defective. Chekhov may have remembered hearing it in his childhood. It does not appear in Russian dictionaries until 1938, and then Chekhov is cited as the source. The first English translator of the play, George Calderon, seems to have confused it with the obscure Russian word nedatyapa from nie not and datapyat to finish chopping, which makes great sense in the context of the play. The critic Batyushkov considered the whole play to be a variation on the theme of nedatyopery, each of the characters representing a different aspect of life unfulfilled. Herein lies the paradox. Seeing Chekhov whole enables one to see the details close up. Scrutinizing the details, one begins to see the whole pattern. This may be why critics have so often had recourse to painting for an analogy. Chekhov's first English translator, George Calderon, likened his style to that of the Acmeists. The poet Randall Jarrell compared Chekhov's technique in Three Sisters to that of Edouard Vuillard. I quote, "The foundation areas on the canvas are made less emphatic by the swarms of particles that mottle the walls with rose-printed paper, the rugs from swirls, the lawns with pools of sun and shade. From such variation and variegation comes his cohesion." My own preferred comparison is with the pointillists, each point of color distinct in itself, yet contributing to a greater whole once one steps away. The translator's duty to preserve these individual speckles of the verbal motifs is not exclusive to Chekhov. It was insisted upon by George Bernard Shaw, who wrote to Siegfried Trebitsch, the German translator of his plays, "The way in which you translate every word just as it comes, and then forget it, and translate it some other way when it begins or should begin to make the audience laugh, is enough to whiten the hair on an author's head. Have you ever read Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing? In it, a man calls a constable an ass. And throughout the rest of the play, the constable can think of nothing but this insult and keeps on saying, 'But forget not, masters, that I am an ass.' Now, if you translated Much Ado, you would make the man call the constable a Schafkopf. On the next page, he would be a Narr, then a Maul, then a Tier, and perhaps the very last time, an Esel." This was such a salient principle for Shaw that he hammered it in the following month. "I tell you again and again, most earnestly and seriously, that unless you repeat the words that I have repeated, you will throw away all the best stage effects and make the play unpopular with the actors. Half the art of dialogue consists in the echoing of words. the tossing back and forwards of phrases from one to another like a cricket ball. What is true for Shaw is true for Chekhov. Nearly 40 years later, the American critic Stark Young, when he set out to translate The Seagull for the Luntz, was surprised to find that the tone, which in a dramatic work is a diffused and intangible but final quality that reveals its general characteristic, had been falsified in earlier English translations of Chekhov. He too singled out those balances, repetitions for stage effect, repetitions for stage economy, theatrical combinations and devices, time patterns, and so on, that are the fruits of much intention and technical craft, and that are almost totally absent from the translation. Of Constance Garnett, he observed that she has a way of missing the point just enough to spoil the more immediate economy, as it were, of a theatrical moment. Greater attention needed to be paid to Chekhov's style. Well, everybody knows Mies van der Rohe's aphorism, God is in the details. Less familiar may be Vladimir Nabokov's, there is no delight without the detail. But most apposite to Chekhov is a notation which Stendhal made in his journal. Everyone acknowledges that whoever tells a story must appear to be speaking the truth. But to do this, one must have the courage to go into the slightest details. This, I think, is the only means of overcoming the reader's distrust. Chekhov, especially in the latter part of his literary career, was a very careful writer and a very economical one. Wherever one sinks the probe into his writing, it hits something solid. The best way to understand Chekhov is not to proceed from general assumptions about intention or meaning, but to inquire closely into the choice of words, the structure of sentences, the rhythms of the prose. Now, this may sound like a retreat to formalism or structuralism, a new critical or purely aesthetic co-optation of an author who many would prefer to enroll under the banner of progress and humane activism, ecology and conservation, to name one of the latest movements. Yet it is, I believe, the appropriate method for dealing with an author so evasive and self-effacing. The shock of the new in Chekhov's handling of familiar topics contributed mightily to his reputation in his lifetime. Chekhov's newness tends to be lost or overlooked and may be recovered by sharper attention to the novelty of his dialogue. As my mentor, the Swedish Chekhovian Niels Åke Nilsson, pointed out, Chekhov is an unacknowledged precursor of the futurists and their launching of a zaumni, or transrational language. He cites as examples the phrase, Tvi tak nagavarilsya, you've gavrilled it up enough, in Ivanov, the tram-tam-tam exchange in Three Sisters, and Gaev's billiard jargon, calling this a new dramatic syntax. Even Stark Young, eager to be faithful to Chekhov, trembled before this novelty. He had to admit that, quote, Chekhov's dialogue is perhaps a trifle more colloquial than mine. Certainly it's more colloquial than I should ever dare to be. For in a translation, any very marked colloquialism is always apt to hurt the economy of effect by raising questions as to what the original could have been to come out so patly as that. Young took as an example Trigorin's remark that when he gets a whiff of heliotrope, skorea mataya naus, quickly I wrap it around my mustache. Now, any good Russian-English dictionary will tell you that this is a figure of speech meaning I make a mental note of something. Perhaps, as Stark Young feared, it is as wrong to translate it literally as it might be to translate he got my goat literally into Russian. Nevertheless, to translate it as Young does, quickly I make a note of it, is to substitute the bland for the colorful. My own solution, bearing in mind first Chekhov's fascination with facial hair, every one of his major plays contains remarks about whiskers, and next that Trigorin is an avid fisherman, my solution is I instantly reel it in on my mustache. His following phrase, Lovlyu v sebe i vas na kazhdoy frazye, Young renders awkwardly as every sentence, every word I say and you say, I lie in wait for it. However, it ought to continue the piscatorial imagery, since Chekhov may have had in mind the biblical idiom to fish in troubled waters, in Russian, lovit rybu v mutnoy vodye. It's well known that from his long boyhood experience as a chorister under his father's tutelage, Chekhov's mind was well stocked with scriptural commonplaces. My solution goes, I'm angling in myself and you for every phrase. I find it striking that these stylistic and linguistic aspects of Chekhov's work are the most neglected by critics, as well as translators. There's a clear preference for the biographical, the thematic, and the compare and contrast approaches. In the English-speaking world, this inattention to Chekhov's language, whether prose or dialogue, is due in part to the fact that a great deal of the commentary is written by those who cannot read him in the original. Such otherwise sophisticated commentators as V.S. Pritchett, Richard Gilman, and J.L. Stein have had no qualms about dilating on Chekhov, secure in the belief the translation will give them all they need. It would be unheard of to write an intensive study of Proust without knowing French, or of Goethe without knowing German. But somehow Chekhov's appeal is so great that enthusiasts choose to ignore the linguistic aspect in the belief that Chekhov's qualities lie in essential, universal issues. Stein's book, Chekhov in Performance, is sedulous in comparing different translations of given lines in order to arrive at some notion of the original. But this method is hardly likely to produce precise results. It may be compared to playing the piano with mittens on. In the theater, this has led to the absurd practice of having someone competent in the language of origin, though not necessarily well-versed in the playwright, translate word for word, and someone competent in the language of reception then produce an acting version. This practice is of long standing, with Alexander Koyransky working for Guthrie McClintock in the 1940s, Leonid Kipnis for Tyrone Guthrie, and Ariadne Nikolaev for John Gielgud in the 1960s, and Marina Lavrova for Peter Brook in the 1980s. The result is always two loosely related translations. The first from the language of origin into flat, deliberately unspeakable English. The latter, a transcription of it into good, presumably stage-worthy English. The process takes one farther and farther away from the original. To exacerbate this, the director often means to function as the author or auteur, which voids the implicit contact with the spectator. After all, if the publicity reads that the play is by Chekhov, the public has a right to see that play and not a fantasia concocted by an adapter or a director. At present, there is a fashion for rough translation, which chops long speeches into telegraphic phrases, simplifying the language and making it easier for short-winded actors. Using this method and a trot provided by a so-called Russian specialist, dramatists remote from Chekhov's sensibility, language, and concerns, such as Pam Jems, Edward Bond, David Mamet, Trevor Griffiths, Peter Barnes, Lanford Wilson, David Hare, Brian Friel, and Richard Nelson, warp him into new shapes which express their own preoccupations. This need of English-speaking playwrights to wrestle Chekhov to the mat has become a compulsively Oedipal rite of passage. Ultimately, individual choices may be less important than general principles. So in conclusion, let me offer a few maxims for anyone planning to translate Chekhov's, or for that matter, anyone's plays. It is not the translator's job to correct or improve the author. Where the characters are incoherent, don't try to make them make sense. Where they are slangy, ungrammatical, or substandard, don't try to regularize them. Where the character is effusive, don't try to restrain him. When a character speaks in rambling sentences full of parentheses, as Ivanov, Trigorin, and Lopakhin are prone to do, don't break them up into smaller units. Trust the author's punctuation. Where the author places an operative word at the beginning or end of a sentence, don't lose it in the middle of a sentence. Where a series of words have the same length or endings, for example, no in Russian adverbs, try to replicate that effect. or a phrase seems unusual or grotesque, try to ascertain if it's a quotation or a cultural reference. A translator should bear in mind that his task is to be less a creator than an interpreter. An interpreter keenly conscious of the intrinsic frailty of this singular mode of interpretation. This is why established dramatists are dangerous when they undertake translation, for they're unwilling to subordinate their own instincts. The essence of a dramatic text lies in its language. Each language creates a particular affective relationship with what the sounds evoke. The hope that this peculiar encounter of sound and sense can be reincarnated in another language is always utopian. On the level of sounds, the experiment of translation is an experiment in uprooting, of problematic transubstantiation. The essential energy of translation consisting in detaching the sense from the letter. Every act of communication is itself a translation. You are translating my words as you hear them into something meaningful for you. And if my students are anything to go by, you're mishearing and misinterpreting in the process. Time, distance, variation in viewpoint and reference only increase the difficulty of transmission. In translating from another language in another time, one feels always in transition, off balance. There is, however, a recompense. Rather than seeing a translation as a deficit in the original language, we can take it as a gain in our own. Submitting the text to so close an inspection and so careful a transplantation, we are entwining it with our own cultural DNA. Thank you.
I mean, you mentioned Chekhov and I'm not that familiar with Chekhov myself, but as a predecessor of the futurist and as someone who was doing radical, that's not normally the way that I think of Chekhov.
Right. No, this was part of Niels Åke Nielsen's thesis that Chekhov is much more radical than people think of him, and particularly in the way he uses language, in the way he will invent a word or use a sentence that's made up strictly of sounds. It's not that Chekhov was programmatically avant-garde, but he's using devices which later writers will make programmatic and will make part of their manifesto. This is what we're going to do.
I think we've all had this sense of these, especially the four big plays, that they're kind of theatrical poems. In which whatever plot there is, in a way, is almost always subordinate to the characters and their interaction. But your sense of the language and the intricacy, the interweaving of the language it's even more convincing that they're they're theater poems.
There was in the 1920s, there was a magazine called The Drama, and a Russian emigre wrote an introductory essay on Russian theater for American audiences. And he's going chronologically through them, and he gets to Chekhov and he says, "Forget it. No, you cannot translate Chekhov into anything that will sound like Chekhov." He even thinks that Ostrovsky is easier to translate, although everybody talks about Ostrovsky as being so Russian that he's untranslatable. But I think what this author was getting at, Gregory Zilburg, was that there is this poetic quality to Chekhov's language. He's sometimes used in beginning Russian classes because the language seems to be so transparent and so simple. But the simplicity is the simplicity of the choice and the way in which the words are put together, and not simply in the lexical meaning of a sentence. And one of the things that Chekhov is very fond of using is something that's very available in Russian and not available in English, which is turning everything into a passive construction in which nobody is the agent. I'll give you, well, I gave you one example. When Uncle Vanya keeps saying, tiajolomenya, literally, heavy to me, heavy on me, as if something from outside is weighing him down. In English, we would say, I'm depressed, or I'm feeling weighed down. But a Russian would not put the I or the ego in front. And huge numbers of these idioms are just everyday language. The end of Act Two in Uncle Vanya. The two women, late at night, want to play piano. And Sonia goes off to see if her sick father, the professor, will let them play the piano that late. And she comes back, and the last line in the act is, "Не надо." Doesn't mean we can't, which is the way it's always translated, or we mustn't. Не, not, not again, an abstract. Not done, not allowed, not necessary. So I've translated it to get the negative in. I went in a different direction entirely. The answer is no. Not my father's answer is no, but just the answer is no. It becomes a kind of abstract which is oppressing them. Phil, thank you very much for your patience.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You have just heard a lecture by Tufts University professor Lawrence Sinelik. Professor Sinelik's lecture was titled Seeing Chekhov Whole on Translating the Complete Plays of Anton Chekhov and was presented by the Boston University Department of Modern Languages and Comparative Literature in the College of Arts and Sciences. Tonight's moderator was Keith Vincent, Assistant Professor of Japanese and Comparative Literature at Boston University. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Paul Vikas. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lidotes. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.